You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Well, we've talked about various aspects of the Christian life in the context of crazy times, and this evening we want to talk about matters of conscience from the book of Romans chapter 14. And so let's just dive right in. The whole chapter actually is about the issue of conscience. And the focus really is on verse 22, where it says, "The faith that you have as your own conviction before God. Happy are those who do not condemn themselves in what they approve." And so that's really kind of a mouthful. It's really important, and we want to unpack it here this evening. This idea of convictions, having your own convictions. Convictions are like your basic beliefs, your core beliefs, the things that are that really define who you are and what you are about. And the reality is that things can be taken from you. Your money can be taken from you. Your reputation can be taken from you. People can be taken out of your lives. You can lose your health. You can lose all kinds of things. But one thing that can never be taken from you is your convictions. And that's really who makes us who we are. It's what enables us as well to draw deeper into relationship. A relationship deepen where we drill down in there to the real motivations of our heart, the longings of our soul, the principles that guide our lives. As those things become increasingly the subject of interaction with people, it opens the door to a world of depth and a connection and partnership just at the most basic core of who we are. And so there's some just direct payoff knowing who we are, knowing what we're about, having this deep set of convictions that enable us to really live a victorious life. And that's where we're going to end on the backside of this talk here. But I want to introduce as well the idea of conscience, because convictions are basic beliefs about who we are, why we matter, what makes life worth living, things like that. How do we treat other people? What's a life well lived? What happens to me when I die? Those core convictions that define who we are guides to our conscience, our moral compass, that ability to continue pursuing the true north. It's our conscience that answers the question, am I on track? That small voice inside your head saying, hey man, you're off the rails. Somewhere, somehow, things have gone the wrong direction for you. It's time to get back on track. That's what conscience does. And as our convictions, our core values about what is important in life and what defines our significance as a person, informs our moral framework, which is what conscience is. These two things working together really define the fundamental core of the human soul. And more precious than anything that we could possibly own is the ability to have a clear sense of what our convictions are and live them out in a manner that is consistent with our conscience. And so we want to talk about that a little bit in the context of a diverse culture, because the reality is in ancient Rome, just as today, I may have a sense of what my convictions are, and you may have yours. And similarly, my moral compass leads me in a particular direction. Yours veers in slightly a different direction. That's what it means to have a diverse culture, a pluralistic culture, a culture where we're not all reading fundamentally off the same page at this deep core level of who we are. And for that reason, then, conflict is inevitable. Significant substantive difference over things that really matter exist in a pluralistic culture. And they certainly that certainly occurred in ancient Rome. Rome was called the cosmopolis, the world city. All roads led to Rome. And in Rome were ethnicities that made up all of the settled Western world at that point. And that was also reflected in the church. So now we're talking about a church that is at best a couple of decades old, meeting in small houses all over the city of Rome, composed of people who are Jews and Gentiles and from North Africa and Asia and Europe and various places. And they're living together despite all their substantial cultural difference. And what begins to emerge is some friction over areas of conviction and conscience. And this chapter really focuses on this issue of eating meat that has been sacrificed to idols. Paul says one person believes it is all right to eat anything, but another believer with a sensitive conscience will eat only vegetables. Now that just sounds kind of crazy, doesn't it? A fight over whether you're a meat eater or a vegetarian. And yet actually this is a pretty important issue for the early church because it represented the Jewish and Gentile worlds coming together. And the reason why there were people who were vegetarians is because most of the meat available to people in the city of Rome had been dedicated to pagan gods in pagan temples. And so just like we have a McDonald's right around the corner out here, you know, if it said McBales or, McZeus or something like that, we would assume that the hamburger that we bought at McZeus had been offered up as a sacrifice to this god. And so there are many people turning from that kind of worship of non-gods to the worship of the one true God in relationship to Jesus Christ. And their conscience began to offend them. That why would I go on eating this meat that has been intentionally sacrificed to idols? Isn't that really idolatry? Isn't that, in fact, the definition of idolatry? And so there just arose this fraying within the church. And that's what this chapter really is all about, is how do we deal with the fact that just as there are significant differences out there in our culture over matters of conviction and conscience, that so too, even in the church, many of those same things are going to exist. How do we deal with that? That's what we want to explore here together this evening. We want to talk about conscience in conflict. Let's talk a little bit about the issue of conscience. We want to talk specifically not about the obvious right and wrongs. You know, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness. I mean, that's just obvious. And people from all manner of culture, even without the Bible, recognize those things as wrong. But we're talking here about something that's a little bit more in the area of the gray. It touches on values. It's really important. But it's not absolutely clear what the right way to look at these things would be. And in that context is potential for great disagreement among conscientious thinking and indeed biblically informed Christians. Areas, for instance, like politics. Man, have we been divided as a society over the last year along political lines and within the church as well. It's been really rough sledding for a lot of people on both sides of the political equilibrium or disequilibrium. And yet, you know, who could claim that somehow God's on my side? You know, that's just not how that works. It's not that clear. And similarly, in the area, for instance, of social distancing, even within families, there are significant differences about what is safe. What does it mean to really care about one another? And so we have differences there. In my own family, my extended family, when my part of my family, my brother and his family came to town just not too long ago, you know, their view of what social distancing was and mine were really, really different. And I could just sense myself feeling uncomfortable around them and sort of sense that they felt the same way. And I realized, you know, neither one of us has some exclusive access to what's true here. But we've come to different convictions about that, and we need to learn how to live together in a context where a variety of opinions are there. Our home churches almost certainly are the same way, where we've got people who have different levels of comfort about being in one another's physical presence during this time. The use of alcohol has been a perennial question in the church, and especially in the global church. I've just been in Africa for the last couple of weeks, where consumption of alcohol among Christians is almost non-existent. And the reason is not because that they're super uptight or whatever. It's that in their culture, which is deeply broken and extremely poor, the use of alcohol is really, it's like stealing from your family's table the food that they really need to eat. And when there's drinking, it's almost always dysfunctional drinking. And so most Christians, by matter of conscience, just simply don't drink. Or there is also issues of family decisions we make. Do both parents work? Does one parent work and the other stay home? There are all kinds of views that are really consequential, but those are matters of conscience that we have to figure out. And so then, how do we account for the disagreements that we have? And here I think, again, there are like four general subject areas that kind of define why Christians reading off literally the same page will come to very different conclusions about some of these things. There's first the issue of culture. And so different cultural orientations have varying views of what's permissible and what's not. What a healthy marriage relationship looks like and what doesn't. What effective parenting is and so forth. There are the issue of our own experiences in life that really shape what we feel that we can within our conscience do or feel that we must abstain from. And that's also something very appropriate and very much relevant to my own self in a way that I don't. The values that government should protect and promote and things like that, but we just prioritize the role of government in different ways. And those ways become significant in terms of our political outlook, but they aren't fundamentally a conflict over values. And so it's really important that we understand both what some of these gray areas are and also why we have moved into an opinion that affects our conscience in these various areas. And with that in mind, then I want to move toward what Paul then begins to unfold in terms of, okay, we've got these differences. Now, what do we do with them? How do we handle different kinds of responses to what's out there? And what about our convictions and our conscience when they differ within the Christian community? Well, that's what we want to talk about right here. He says in verse 1, accept one another who is weak in faith, but not for the purpose of passing judgment on their opinions. One eats meat and is not to treat with contempt the person who only eats vegetables. He says profoundly in verse 4, who are you to judge the servant of another? It's a pretty good question. But the paragraph really is about acceptance. He says, accept one another. And so here, Paul is putting forward the acceptance of a person as the primary issue over the issues that might divide us. You see that? Accept one another. But he says, we accept the person, but not for the purpose of passing judgment on their opinions. In other words, accepting a person is not the same as agreeing with them. Well, that's really important because in our day, we're confused on that point. The most unhelpful demand in our society today is, if you accept me, you have to believe what I think is true and that it's the way it is. Some years back, I had a relationship that was extremely important to me, a valuable long-term relationship. And this person was in a situation where she felt the need to be understood and protected. And I'm like, I get that, and I'm with you. And she said, and that means that you must accept as true my accounting of the situation that I'm in. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not sure I can do that. I love you. I care for you. I'm there for you. But you cannot call upon me to agree with your take on things as a precondition for experiencing my support for you. And that led to years of significant tension between us. And I think that there's a lot of that that goes on in our society today, where we're confusing the acceptance of a person with the agreement of what the person has to say about their value system or about what they think is right or wrong or whatever it is. And that is always going to alienate people from each other. What we need to do is love and care for people because every person is in the image of God. The basis upon our concern isn't that we agree with them. It's that God values them, that they are of incredible cosmic value to God, so much so that he was willing to enter into the world on their behalf and take upon his own body the burden of their sin. That's why we love and care for people. That's why we're willing to accept people, because God does, not because we necessarily agree with them. But having said that, Paul then, you know, kind of focuses on the inevitable thing that goes on in our twisted little hearts. He says, don't hold the other person with contempt. And so that is just a straight up, you know, you don't know everything about this person. You don't know how they came to this point in their life to hold the convictions and views that they did. And so it's time for you to stand down, not being their moral superior or whatever it is, condescending to them. We've got to watch our attitudes, and then specifically that we're not to judge the other person. That's something that only God has the prerogative to do. In 1 Corinthians 5, verse 12, Paul says to the broader culture, he says, who am I to judge those who are outside the church? You know, it's a funny thing that today in our culture, the church is known as kind of the finger wagger of our society, the kind of judging, the force of judgment. But Paul is saying, you know, that's really not our job. The Holy Spirit is more than capable of convicting people of their sin, of God's righteousness, and the reality of his judgment. Our job is to move toward people as God has moved toward us, graciously and with love. That is the issue. So I think that this principle of acceptance is really super important if people who have very different points of view and their conscience kind of bends in slightly different directions, if we're going to be able to really connect and live out our life together, we're going to have to really work hard to accept each other. And then he says in verse 10, we all stand before the judgment seat of God. It is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue will give praise to God. So then, each one of us will give an account to God. And so, yeah, we accept one another, recognizing that they, like us, ultimately, are accountable to God. That we are responsible for our choices. We're responsible for the core values that we have chosen to guide and live our lives by. We're responsible for how we use the talents that God has given to us. Jesus gives a parable to this effect in Matthew chapter 25. He's like, you know, God has given to people various quantities of talent, some 2, some 5, some 10 talents. And he said, you know, the basic parable is that there's going to come a time where we will all give account for the things that God has given to us, the resources that he's given to us. But we answer to God for that, not to one another. And indeed, the whole question of God judging in this context in verse 10 is significant. The judgment seat of God, it says. The word in the Greek is the bema. And that is not just this place of a judge rendering the verdict, guilty or not guilty. The bema is actually a rewards tribunal. That God has given to us gifts that he has called upon us to employ for the sake of his glory and our benefit. That's what verse 11 is about. And that at the end of time, we will come before God, and God will grant us reward for our willingness to take stock of these incredible resources that he has given to us and bless our lives even beyond our eternal salvation and our eternal fellowship with him. And so we are accountable to God, and we will come to a place where following that moral compass, following that true north, really living out biblical principles as we understand them is something that God is excited about and that God ultimately will reward us for. Third, he says in verse 13, so let us not judge one another anymore, but rather determine this, not to put an obstacle or a stumbling block in a brother's way. If because of food, your brother is hurt, you're no longer walking in love. And so there's a great principle here, which is namely to lower the barriers, that don't put a stumbling block in your brother's way. And so here we're just taking our freedom and we're choosing to limit the exercise of our freedom for the sake of the fragility of another person's conscience, that we want to avoid damaging controversy by respecting differences. Okay, and so there are things that people, even if they are, from your perspective, your understanding, they're wrong and they're imbalanced in this gray area, like alcohol, for instance. What do you do? Well, mostly what you want to do is make it a non-issue, because it's not an issue with God. And so it ought not to be an issue that comes between yourself and that other person. So we find ways to not offend or take offense. But more than that, too, it isn't just a matter of limiting freedom for the sake of non-offense. There's also a place here in removing obstacles or stumbling blocks to really be in a relationship that cultivates real understanding, finding places for productive exchange of ideas. And so, okay, here we disagree with each other, maybe vehemently, and maybe about things that really matter. But that shouldn't be the end of the story, and I shouldn't just avoid talking about things that might be upsetting, right? So we need to find ways to come together and respectfully engage some of those differences as well, because the not doing that would just keep us at a kind of a isolated distance from one another. We won't have that kind of synergy of cooperation and faith and love and affection for one another that we otherwise would. Every other week, I get together with two other guys that I've known for decades at this point and have worked with very closely. And one of the two could not be more different than me politically. And I won't tell you where he's at, and I won't tell you where I'm at. It's for you to ponder and be wrong about. But the interesting thing is that we are both completely sold out servants for Christ. That's what our North Star is. That's what our conscience is driving us to. That is where our convictions lie. And in that context, over the last few years, and especially over this year, we have had robust, respectful, informed, and I think actually very stimulating and helpful interaction about some of the things that are dividing our society apart more than anything today. It can be done, and it should be done. We should be able to have honest, respectful, gracious dialogue with one another, even about things that we are divided about as a society. And Christians have a basis to come together and allow a process of time to work through our differences and to learn from each other and to cultivate deeper understanding. And we should be this way. Otherwise, we're just going to flock to our own little silos, and we're just going to listen to people who agree with us, and that's going to make it much more difficult for us to stand up as lights to the world and salt for a society that is just so divided. They don't know how to put things together. We need to be able to show how that's done. Fourth, he says, so then pursue the things which make for peace and the building up of one another. Okay, so we may have some significant differences in the area of our convictions. Our moral compass might be moving us, northeast, where someone else is going a bit northwest or whatever. Paul here is making an important point that we're to pursue peace. That is to say, we need to keep our sights set on what matters, that we need to major in the major, not the things that divide us, but rather the things that unite us. That's the focus, and that's what it means to be a peacemaker. And then he goes on, and I think he says something very important here about building up one another, that the focus of our attention should be on what people really need. And here I have found over and over again that the reason why people adopt viewpoints often that are different than mine for sure, or maybe other people's, you know, isn't because they thought it all through carefully, but rather because they're reacting to experiences, things that have gone down in their life. And so maybe they're angry, or maybe they're hurt, or they just feel chronically misunderstood, or whatever it might be. And that emotional orientation, you know, is an attitude looking for a worldview. And that's why so many of the people in our culture today are so deeply cynical. They've grown up in families, for instance, where marriage hasn't worked, whereas children, they've been more or less left to their own devices, things like that. They haven't really learned how to form deep bonds with other human beings, and they're angry, they're hurt, and they begin to develop worldviews that reflect that kind of alienation. And so what's the answer? A big part of it is right here. It's where we move alongside and extend the love of Christ and build that other person up. That we love and accept and affirm them, just as our first principle indicated. We're committed to meeting their real needs. And what we see over a period of time then is that some of that hostility begins to fade. Some of the anger begins to loosen. And instead, there is a growing sense that people can be relied upon, that they're trustworthy. And so their grip on cynical outlooks begins to dissipate and heal. And that is something that is beautiful to watch. And that happens in this church all the time. Now, last, he says in verse 5, as we said earlier, and in verse 22, same thing, the beginning and the end of the passage. Each person must be convinced in their own mind. The faith that you have as your own conviction before God. Happy are those who do not condemn themselves on what they approve. Now, let's just unpack this briefly. He says, have convictions. Be a person of conviction. Be convinced in your own mind. Now, why is that important to put an exclamation point after? Because in our culture, the answer to different convictions and different moral systems and stuff like that is to simply not take anything seriously. It's the relativism of our day that basically says there is no objective truth for us to follow. So we just define it as we go, which means really we just know we're making it up, right? There's nothing real to live for. If there's nothing real about why we matter as human beings, if there's nothing real and substantive about why people matter and therefore things like justice and stuff like that are true and objective and real, then we're really in trouble. But that is where we are as a society. We're being told basically that we ought not to have strong convictions because convictions set people against each other. And so we're basically just smothered with it's the air that we breathe. Don't take your belief so seriously that you would actually offend the sensibilities of someone else. And my friends, this is devastating. It's devastating to us as human beings in the image of God, and it's devastating to us socially. Let's be clear. Disagreeing with another person doesn't make you a hater. Okay? So, in our culture now, if you say something, even if it's motivated by love and said with grace and sensitivity, but it amounts to a disagreement with what someone has said or believes, you know, that tag hater is put on. And I just want to tell you how incredibly, appallingly dangerous it is to accept that point of view. It's not hate to disagree. It can be hateful to diminish that person's dignity and value, to not accept that person. That's right. That would be wrong indeed. But disagreeing is actually a super important part of coming to a growing conviction and clarity about the things that really matter. The opposite, to not have the ability to substantively disagree means that everyone is always right about what they believe at all times. I don't want to live in a world like that. That sounds scary to me, right? And so we do need to be able to engage with one another in the Christian community and be not afraid to offer disagreement with one another under the shroud of acceptance and grace, and also recognize that we should test our convictions. And we should test our convictions and not ghost those people who challenge them. That terminology is so bizarre. Ghosting, the grown-up way of putting your fingers in your ears and going, I can't hear you. Like a child. And yet that's sort of the new social practice, is if someone says something, then you don't agree with it. You just dismiss them, and now the relationship is over. And just how arrogant that is and how foolish it is as though no one has anything meaningful to say to your life, that what you believe is always true. And if that's what we think, then there's no place for real substantive human interaction, of a meaningful discussion of ideas, of advancing argument and putting forth challenges to one another. The reality is that faith is something that is a tested conviction. Faith is not just, I believe it and so I'm just going to walk, off the cliff or whatever. Faith in the biblical sense is rooted in the conviction that certain things are true, and that therefore we can engage our mind and examine the foundation of our faith and walk with increased clarity about our faith in a pluralistic society, which enables us then to be able to sensitively and graciously engage other people in conversation about the things that really matter. We should never be afraid of disagreement. Of course not. That's how we find the truth. So these, I think, are five principles that we see in Romans 14 that Paul is rolling out for us to become the kind of community where we have genuine openness and genuine acceptance and regard for one another, and are also able, under the guise of that gracious acceptance, to work out our differences. And I think that there are huge implications to this in a couple of ways. First, that having true convictions produces soul satisfaction. Soul satisfaction. The idea that I've really thought this through, that what I really believe and am basing my life on stands up to matters of evidence and reason, that I can engage the objections that are lodged against my faith in such a way that I'm not undone by them, but I'm able to grow in my faith through those things. And as we bring together our core convictions and our conscience that guide us in a way of living, there is something so beautiful, so positive, so absolutely transforming that it doesn't matter what people take from us. They can take our money, they can take our reputation, they can take our health, they can do whatever they want, but they can't take that. And that is the key to the whole thing. Watchman Nee, that's a picture of him right there, grew up in China in the first half of the 20th century. He was really the one used by God more than any to establish a network of underground churches that survived many decades of communist rule and really up to the present day. And he recounts a story. He was a brilliant student. And he recounts a story as he was later in his life, and he was poor, and he just every time he had money, he'd give it to poor people, and he just didn't have much of anything at all, and his clothes were sort of ragged. And he was on a train one day, sitting next to a man who was really well-dressed, and all of a sudden he realized, this is somebody I went to school with, who'd become a rich and very successful attorney. And they had this interaction where the guy's like, you know, I can see what happened to you, Watchman Nee. You know, you're a loser. Look at you. And just that, for him to be able to process that through and to realize, I am so much richer than this person will ever know. Because I've got my convictions and my moral compass driving my life into things that are productive and meaningful and eternally significant. And that's just pretty awesome. Now, for the sake of discussion, a couple things. I think in a practical way, when I ask this question, what are some helpful ways we can develop deeper convictions? How can we really set our roots deep in the area of truth that provides a basis for our life? And then secondly, I think this is really key, how might you connect with friends in an area of conscience that might provide a sweet point of common ground for deeper conversation? And what I mean there is that there are plenty of people in our lives who do not know Christ, who are still driven by deep conviction and a moral framework. And how does the existence of those convictions and a moral framework provide for us an opportunity for real common ground together and therefore for deeper conversation about what is the basis for those moral convictions, for that outlook on life? A door, in other words, to the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.